the other mentors. We covered a lot of ground here today, essentially. So we talked about all the basic principles of Kfiyah B'Mitzvos. We went already into Kfiyah B'Gittin. Talked about the basic issues there, about the different views in Rishonim that seem to emerge as far as what Kfiyah B'Gittin is based on. So any questions on any of that? We spoke about the Rashbam, Tosfos, all those things. Any issues there? Any questions? Okay, so then to continue with the Rambam, so we had discussed the question of, say, the Rambam's assumption that the mitzvah is the big factor, that the rotza ani can be addressed through the mitzvah, which, you know, one has to clarify a little bit how much we're saying there. Are we saying that therefore it's the mitzvah that justifies the kfiyah, or are we saying the kfiyah comes maybe from somewhere else, but the mitzvah has to be invoked in order to deal with the ratzon? Because since it has to be beratzon, so the Rambam has to explain how is this get considered to be beratzon when he's saying no. So he says, well, the mitzvah is what does it. A little bit of room to clarify about that. Let's work under the assumption here that it is the mitzvah that's doing it. And the Rambam's explanation is that the Yitzhahara essentially has been weakened. That basically his inner ratzon is to do the mitzvos, the Yetzirah is getting in the way, so since that's been beaten up, so to speak, so now the Yetzirah is no longer the dominant force. We spoke a little bit about how this can be compared to some of the discussions in the Rishonim, the more philosophically oriented Rishonim, say for Ikarim and others, the questions of Paro, you know, how do we understand how Paro seemed to be deprived of his free will, according to what it sounds like from Sukkim and Chumash. And there was some discussion about, you know, what's more free will, the free will that he had with the Makos or without the Makos. Let's say, for example, that, or with the hardening of the heart, that the Makos maybe themselves would have been non-free will had he decided to give in to the Makos and release the Jews because of that. And therefore, the hardening of the heart, from the Rishonim understood, was a way to resist the forces of the Makos, and therefore what he did actually reflected the real him. So too, here could be the Yetzirah, and this muscle is comparable to the Makos. That's what's getting in the way of the real husband. And getting rid of the Yetzirah, which in this case the Kfiyah is Dome to the hardening of the heart, it's a rough muscle, but the idea being that we don't really know what it is that reflects the true you, what reflects pressure, essentially, and to equalize those forces. So, under those circumstances, that's what it seems like the Rambam is saying, and there's been a lot of discussion about this. The Nesivus in Reish Hay talks about the whole fact that if we want to compare this to Kinyanim, so if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, so we don't find that by Kinyanim there's a need to say Rotza Ani. So he understands that the Rotza Ani is there because of the higher degree of ratzon that a get needs. So it's even though on one level the Gemara is comparing it to Mechira, as we discussed yesterday, but then there's a difference. A get needs ratzon and Mechira doesn't need ratzon. So we discussed in this context the somewhat complicated issue. I know that some had some issues with this, so we'll do it a little bit more slowly. The question of the position of the Chavos Yar that takes issue with the Rambam. So basically the issue was as follows, that the Rambam basically is maintaining that really he wants to give the get, and the Yetzirah is in the way, so the Kfiyah gets rid of the Yetzirah. So says the Chavos Yar, it's extremely hot in here. He would say that today also if he was in this room. So you see how things have not changed much since this time. So trying to distract himself from the heat, he then commented that the Rambam's position he finds difficult. He has great lashon, a great deference to the Rambam with his language. He says, but despite the Rambam's beautiful svara, he doesn't think it's true. And the key nakuda that troubles him is that how could you say the Yetzirah has been knocked out? This is, again, focused on this point. This is where the point of reference is, that the Yetzirah is still there, because, or the real him is still acting like the Yetzirah, because if the beatings stop, if he knew for sure that the beatings would stop, then he would not give the get. That's the premise. So it's not like, okay, we took the fight out of him and now he's giving it willingly. He's only doing it because he feels it's still going to keep coming. So therefore, that's the threat of the future, not the present, that's operating. If it's the threat of the future, why is that not straight fear? So therefore, says the Chafetz Chaim, you have to say that that's really a napshot. You have to say it's a whole different understanding of what's going on. Go back to Dvarim Shebelev and Dvarim kind of idea, that really, essentially, the issue is that the point of him saying Rotzani is to convey that even if, although Holland's going to fly in, is that the issue?
It's snowing.
Well, it looks like it's snowing or something. All right, we'll see what happens. This time of year, you always have interesting elemental aspects. Okay, anyway, we'll go back and forth, we'll see what happens with this. But essentially, says the Chavis Yair, that the purpose of Rotzani is in order to establish just that point. That he's going to say that I'll give the get even if I know that there aren't going to be any more machas. Even if I know there's not going to be any more pressure, I'll still give the get. But that's not true. So he says, for our purposes, it is true, because it's a rational thing to say, because, again, hearkening back a little bit to the Rashbam, there's no benefit to this guy to stay married. He's not getting anything out of it. He's just hurting her. He's not getting anything for himself. So it's not like you're making somebody say something which is completely nonsensical. It's the kind of thing a reasonable mensch, we hope, would say. So therefore, it's valid on its face. So coupled with the outward expression of Rotzani, that's what makes it work. So that's how the Chavis Yair understands, which is fundamentally different from the Rambam's explanation. Okay, so far so good? So to that, the Eilu Shekofa Mahotzi says, no, he thinks that the Rambam is still correct. He says, don't pay so much attention to the fact that he would still remain in his recalcitrance if the beating stopped. That's not so significant. Because, says Moshul Mahadavar Dolmen, that imagine if you have somebody who's kidnapped, and his captors are holding him hostage. And then his friends come and they start wailing on the captors. So while the captors are being beaten up, the hostage can run away. Now, it may still be true that if they'll stop hitting the captors, then the captors will immediately chase after the guy again, recapture him, and restore him to his captivity. Okay, fine. But while they're being beaten up, the prisoner is free. And the prisoner can act in his own free will. So why don't we say that here as well? Right? The Yetzer Hara refers to the captors. The beatings refer to the friends. So let's say that, yes, it's still true that, okay, if we'll stop beating, then the Yetzer Hara will come back in full force. Okay, but it still means that the Yetzer Hara is still an external force, and the inner principle Yid still is there, and yes, okay, he only can express himself during the actual time of the beating of the Yetzer Hara, but still it's true. Still the point still remains. That's essentially his analysis. So this affects another major issue that if you saw, I won't spend so much time getting into the names here, but you saw the Beis Yosef, quoted Ma'arik, and there were a few others, who raised the question that according to the Rambam, is this still a valid approach when dealing with a mashomer or a mummer? Now, let's say you have somebody who has declared that he's not interested in the Torah at all, whether it's mitzvahs in general or whether it's the whole religion, he's converted out, he's a mashomer. So then maybe we should say that this principle doesn't apply. The Pintel Yid is not there. Now, there are clearly Rishonim and Achronim who thought this was a valid objection to the Rambam, even though one could say, why is it so compelling? Right? Why shouldn't we say that to be one asking?
Yeah, it's made the Rambam should tell them, still say that he's still in inside, just
because
of that. Yeah. Because just that he's a mummer, that's just the different idea that he's doing, as opposed to, it's the same thing as not wanting to get in the first place, that his heart is reflecting itself in a different way.
Correct.
Or so the same way, more extreme, you could say. But it doesn't change. But I don't think it's necessarily the time of it. It doesn't necessarily change, you know, you have a belief that you can't convert out. Mm-hmm. It doesn't, and nothing changes the fact that it's still a Jew.
Correct. So I think that there's, you know, it's hard to be kovea one way or another. It seems to be a question of judgment and maybe experience in terms of what you've seen. But I certainly hear where you're coming from, as do many others. So some Gedolei Achronim, such as the Chazon Ish, and others, the Chasam Sofer, also seem to understand that, yeah, why should you limit it? Why shouldn't you say that the same way he's committing this one Aveira, but we assume that he really wants to do mitzvos, maybe it's true if he's doing all the Aveiras, if he's completely thrown out the religion. And this is very practical as far as, you know, our maintaining hope in people nowadays who have left the fold to whatever degree. And I'm sure we've all heard stories of people who have come back from very, very far away, even after actual apostasy, actual converting out. So one could hear that the Rambam Svara applies even in such a setting, and that's how many Gedolei Achronim thought was still compelling. But we still have to acknowledge that there were among the Rishonim and the Achronim who thought the other way, who thought that the Rambam's logic would not work in such a case. So just to finish this point, Eilu Shekofim Lahotzi, so he also was sympathetic to Adin's perspective and said that, you know, we could certainly hear the Svara even from Shulman, but still, let's try to explain why there are those who feel otherwise. So to explain that perspective, to continue with his mashal, so let's take the same mashal we said a minute ago, but let's assume that you have a certain type of personality, Stockholm Syndrome, or whatever you want to call it, where somebody has become identified with his captor, somebody has decided he does not want to be set free anymore. So maybe there is a person who, even at the moment when the captors are being beaten up, he still says, no, I'm not going to, I don't want to leave, I want to stay here. I'm going to stay here. So if that's the case, so then maybe that's what they're comparing the Meshumna to, which, again, you can still quibble with, because all this answer tells you is that such a model could exist. Is that necessarily true about contemporary Meshumna? Maybe, maybe not. It doesn't necessarily make the point more compelling. It just explains the scenario why it might be true. That maybe, using that muscle, there is a scenario where, even in that case, the person wouldn't want to leave. And when we were up to this point, I think it was Pesach time, I think it was Morty who pointed out, we can make a good sushdel to Pesach, and to the 80% of the Jews who didn't want to leave Egypt, and of course, you know, there is such a madrega that even the Eved's not going to want to leave after he's set free. So, keeping the mushel, one could take it to a place where it would explain the position of those who felt that Rambam's view wouldn't work in that case, and still it's questionable. Now, even those who feel Rambam's position won't explain or wouldn't be adequate for Meshumar, so they may still say that it could work, that if you take an Afkeinu model, then maybe that's still a possible approach. It's not the end of the whole story, it's just that the Rambam's logic may not necessarily work for a Meshumar if one understands it that way. Who was that before? Did you have a question?
Is that considered kafiyah then, if he doesn't want to leave?
Well, it's definitely, I mean, it's kafiyah either way. That point is, it seems what, for sure it's kfiyah from the beginning. The question is, it's successful kfiyah. So,
meaning, if he doesn't want to leave, is there really any point of forcing him to leave because he doesn't want to?
Well, that's the whole point. That point is, for sure, the whole case we're talking about is that he doesn't want to fulfill the mitzvah, in this case, the mitzvah of divorcing his wife. So, in every scenario, he's recalcitrant. The question is, that the Rambam says, well, yeah, he's recalcitrant, but really inside he wants to do it. So the question here is there a scenario where even the very broad perspective of the Rambam would say, well, but there is a person who we can't say that about. So is that the case? So some thought yes. And this is what the mashal was being used to explain why you could envision such a thing. But again, even with the mashal, it doesn't necessarily mean it's true. It might still be that even a person who's converted out, I mentioned the biography I've read of somebody who had converted, and when he got sick in his later life, said it's going to take more than that to kill this old Jew. And, people still identify as Pintel Yid. Many jokes about this and all that. Various non-Jewish people who are slowly revealed as hidden Jews. It's not an uncommon scenario that somebody may officially convert or do any other act of leaving and still feel some deep connection. Okay, so it's a little bit of an open point, but that's a discussion you find as well. Okay, so the major issue then, as we also, I think, started to allude to yesterday, is the question of, so what scenarios allow for kfiyah? So you have, on the one hand, the cases that are mentioned in the Gemara, which there are a number of. The primary source, I guess, was that Mishnah Daf Ayin Zayin, the two Mishnahs in Ayin Zayin, which talk about situations where there are physical ailments that the husband has that the woman is not able to be expected to, or cannot be expected to be able to live with. And the question of, you know, a few other cases in the Gemara where if they don't have children, they can't have children. You know, the Gemara discusses that the wife has a right to children even if there's no mitzvah for her, but still she has a right to say she wants the support of having children. So, you know, various scenarios where the Gemara talks about kfiya. And then the question is, are we limited to those scenarios or not? Is it only those cases? So that's a major debate in the Rishonim. And the Shulchan Aruch seems to be following the view of the Rush and his Chuvas, where he is among many who are more machmir about this. And it assumes that it's limited specifically to the cases that you find in Chazal and that you don't have the right to go further. And in general, you find the various schools of thought within the Rishonim, those who are much more conservative in their approach to when they would allow kfiya. You can find sources that say they don't do kfiya nowadays at all. But clearly the Gemara acknowledges the possibility of kfiya, so there are those who are very conservative in terms of how to apply that, and there are those who are ready to be a little bit more liberal about it. The Shulchan Aruch seems to follow the view of the Rush and the Chuvas that it's more conservative. Now, you could ask, is that because of the Lumdus? That is it because the Rambam maintains that it's the mitzvah that makes it work, and therefore mitzvah we could generate relatively easily? I shouldn't say easily, but at least it's possible. So if you have a Bezdin, the Bezdin is going to decide that there has to be kfiya, so then that should create a mitzvah. So therefore, even if it's not a situation that's mentioned in Mishnah, or mentioned in the Gemara, then it would seem like you'd have more possibilities. While if one takes an Afkeinu model, I think we discussed yesterday a little bit how it's a little bit questionable, the Radbaz has this phrase, sounds like it's Afkeinu that's taking place. Whether that's what he means or not, as we mentioned that with Gardner and Hissef thought it meant something else, others thought it did mean that, others brought a bunch of other Rishonim that sound like they are alluding to that type of lumdus. So if it's Afkeinu, then maybe you could understand why it is that we should limit it only to the cases that are in the Gemara. That the Gemara says these are cases that Chazal have determined are not possible marriages, are not viable, livable marriages, and therefore they said essentially that it's no good. So that leaves us with a very limited list that only the cases that are in the Gemara, although one still could possibly take the approach, but if I can characterize a current situation that I understand that as fitting into the cases of the Gemara, then maybe it still would apply. So we mentioned, I think it was just yesterday already, that let's say the couple's not living together. So in the Sefer, Eilu Shekhov from Lahotzi, so he quotes a relatively obscure Sefer, it's Kanaran Halevi, who says that that justifies fiyah. And that's a pretty radical position, because again, you see that it's a big stakes, it's high stakes, whether you make a mistake, whether you land on one issue here or not. And to make a mistake here is not a simple thing. So it's a relatively obscure Sefer, considering how consequential the position is. Chaim Pelagi also has a similar idea, where he talks about after an 18-month separation, he thinks that there's a room to force a divorce, and with Nassim Bishtetler, his Shuva said, wait a minute, you're going to have a Gemusa there, it's going to be a problem, you don't have the right to say that that's a basis for kfiya. But we also mentioned that the Reshechter Shlita Midanafshe, you know, without quoting this kind of analogy, but Reshechter has expressed a very similar understanding, that if a couple is not living together, then that is less of a marriage than what the Mishnayos talk about. The Mishnayos are describing scenarios where essentially you don't really have a marriage, so then if they're not living together, then for sure you don't have a marriage. Now, why would you disagree with that? So you could disagree with it maybe because you still have a very conservative approach and say only exactly what's in the Mishnah and you don't have the right to build onto it. Or, I think at the time we were talking about this, we were also mentioning the Shech Hashita about shaving during Chol HaMoed, where he had explained that that's not a chiddush, that's essentially what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah says you can shave hair that hasn't grown yet, so he understands that to be not a new opinion, but an application of what the Mishnah says. So here, the Shetasa, you know, that's what the Mishnah says. But one could also say that, well, maybe the Mishnah is saying not just that there's no marriage, but there's a negative marriage. But if it's an intolerable life, so then be a kofa lahotzi, but maybe not if it's simply neutral, if they're not together at all. So in any event, so this is a question, whether or not that would justify kfiyah. That would have pretty broad implications, because that would address most of the scenarios that we talk about today. In pretty much every case where you're asked to come to a rally or something like that, the circumstances are that the couple's not living together. That's generally the case. Otherwise, prenup doesn't kick in until the couple's not living together. So all the cases that we deal with today would have that circumstance. So if one adopts the Shafi's position on this, then theoretically would be justified. Now, again, it's a controversial position, and I want to just also emphasize Lemaisa, that that does not mean that the steps that we take nowadays constitute fear. We still might advise a more conservative approach because of the Machlokas and because of other things. And the Schefter himself also maintains that kfiyah is not viable in America because it's against the Dina de Malchus Adina. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean it's always against the Dina de Malchus Adina, that there are certain kinds of kfiyah which are against the Dina de Malchus Adina. That, for example, the types of kfiyah that there recently was a trial about, if you're committing actual crimes, such as kidnapping and assault and things like that, things that the government actually prohibits on pain of imprisonment. So that's an example of Dina de Malchus Adina prohibiting it. And also, what Rav Schefter is discussing in a little bit more detail is, if we're talking about, let's say, trying to invoke the government's influence, if the government bans it, so then church and state, if that's the idea, so that's also something which is a function of Dina Malchus Adina and is binding on Jews. In both cases, presumably what Rav Schefter means, as he explained, part of it at least, is that there's always a discussion if Dina Malchus Adina govern behavior between two Jews. We know that we're obligated to pay taxes, things like that, to respect the law of the land vis-a-vis the land. But let's say vis-a-vis two Jews acting towards each other. So we have Choshen Mishpat. So do we say Choshen Mishpat is what regulates the behavior? Or do we say that it's a situation of, or do we say that that's let's phrase it differently. So do we say that the Malchus Adina is going to be what regulates between the two Jews? Or do we say, no, Choshen Mishpat regulates between the two Jews? So that's the whole discussion. Shafir often talks about this topic in Dina Malchus Adina, that even though we have a Choshen Mishpat, which should tell two Jews how to treat each other, but, and we normally assume Dina Malchus Adina does not override, it's a much longer discussion, just giving you a slight taste of it, but institutions which the government puts in, with Tikkun HaMedina for the general welfare of the citizens of the country, so that applies to everybody, to Jews, Gabe Jews, and everybody else. So, for example, the example that she often quotes is, let's say, rent control. So, in the time of Rav Henkin, who was a Gadol HaDor in America 100 years ago, so Rav Henkin dealt with the question that there were Jewish landlords who had Jewish tenants who felt that they didn't have to abide by rent control laws because, since it's between two Jews, so they only have Choshen Mishpat guiding them and they don't have to worry about the rent control and they can raise the rent as much as they want. So, if that's the case, so if that's the case, so then that would be very significant. Except said Rav Henkin that no, this is Mishum Tikkun HaMedina. This is something that we have for the welfare of the citizenry, and therefore that should include Gabe Jews as well. So therefore, rent control applies. And as Rav Schefter says, so separation of church and state, that's what we need in order to function as Jews in America, so that's our benefit, so that also applies. And presumably also the rules prohibiting assault and battery and kidnapping, which I think we all agree is a good policy to have for the most part. So we...
To have
the government stopping those things from happening. So if that's the case, so we should assume that that applies as well. So therefore, there's big barriers to doing kfiyah nowadays in America. However, and as a general point, there are areas in between. There are things that the government does not prohibit, which might still be considered kfiyah, according to some postings. So that would be a big nachimina. Again, this issue is a very subtle issue, a lot of moving parts. So we have to figure out if, you know, things like when we talk about halachos terbein tam, which we have yet to chazer, but things like that, if that's considered kfiyah, there are some who thought it is, it's not necessarily something the government prohibits, so then it'll be a big nachimina whether or not, at least theoretically, kfiyah is possible in those cases. Okay, so that's a big question. So do we have circumstances which justify kfiyah beyond the cases mentioned in the Mishnah? We also mentioned, for example, the Ramah quotes the possibility that somebody who's Roa Zonos maybe could be grounds for kfiyah, and that's based on the source in Rishonim, and there are a couple of different reasons why that is. It could be because that creates a sense of disgust that she can be expected to not have to endure, or it could be because it means she's going to end up spending all of her money and is not going to be able to support them, in which case you would say it should extend to other things such as addictive gambling, or maybe it's even more true. So you have to figure out exactly how to apply these models. Also has the fact there that also could expose the wife to disease, and that's an even more relevant factor today. That factor has even been invoked as grounds for mekachtos, for bittul the whole kedushin. So that's also a element that has to be considered. But the big variable and the big subject of a lot of machlokes is moed halal. So what about moed halal? So where does that factor in terms of increasing the possibility of fear? So here you find a lot of major machlokes, because moed halal we know is a real din from the Gemara, and the problem is we don't know exactly what it signifies, and exactly what it means. Basically, what the Gemara tells us is that there is a concept of a moredes. Moredes means a woman who rebels, and before we assume that that's a male chauvinist statement saying that it's up to her to rebel against the husband because the husband is the master, the Mishnah makes it clear that you could rebel in either way, that the wife could rebel or the husband can rebel. The rebellion is not against the master, it's against the marriage. So the wife can rebel against the marriage, the husband can rebel against the marriage, and there's consequences in either way. So there's consequences, the Mishnah talks about consequences for the Ksuba. Again, in both ways, if the wife is Moredes, then she could lose her entire Ksuba, she could lose her Ksuba in a prorated fashion, and if the husband is Moredes, he could end up having to pay more Ksuba. So there's consequences in both directions. And the Gemara eventually talks about the whole scheme of how it would be publicized, let's say that she was a Moredes, and how that would be addressed. So in the context of Moredes, the Gemara also has a machlokas, what is the act of Merida? Is it, if you're saying, okay, we're rebelling against the marriage, what does it mean to rebel against the marriage? Does it mean you're not going to be involved in the financial component? Is that what we're talking about? He's not going to support her, she's not going to provide masi adeh, something like that. Or does it mean the physical component, which it seems like at least it means that if either one says they're not going to be involved physically with the other, so then that would seem to be an act of merida. So in that context, so the Gemara asks, what is the reason? We ask her, what's the reason why she's being meredes? Is it that she wants the marriage, but she just wants to hurt him? That's real merida? Or is it that she finds him repulsive? That's the expression, moyes alai. So if she finds him repulsive, so it seems like that's more understandable. But what does that mean? La halacha is not clear. And so we know that we didn't go through all of them, just to be aware that there are as many as 7 different opinions in the Rishonim figuring out what the nafkamina is of moed halal. Does it have to do with telling them to get divorced? Does it have to do with waiting 12 months first in order to see if things get better? Does it have to do with implications for the ksuba, for nisim malok, for other types of property. There's a bunch of different permutations. We didn't go through them. We wouldn't expect to know them all, but just to be aware that there's a lot of ambiguity from the Gemara in terms of what is the implication of Moed Salai. So the takeaway being that Moed Salai is a concept from the Gemara, but what its impact on practical halacha is not at all clear from the Gemara, and therefore we have a major difference among the Rishonim as to how it applies. So the biggest statement here is the Rambam's position, that the Rambam says that one can force a divorce, and one should force a divorce, if the wife says Moed Salai. In between, there is the view of some of the Gaonim, which did not seem to make it to widespread acceptance, that there was a later Takana, that we should force a divorce because of Moed Salai, and a lot of the Rishonim assume that that's not the case of the halacha, and some of the debate about that was what was quoted and what we said a few minutes ago about whether after Inu is really the play. So, for example, the Ritva says, oh, we don't accept the Tachanas HaGaonim because called Makadesh Adaita the Rabbanan, not Adaita the Gaonim, meaning that it sounds like he's saying after Inu is a real mechanism, and just the later Gaonim don't have the right to do that. Others also use similar language in describing it, positively and negatively. So that's another area, another position of the Rishonim where Moed Salai is involved. This is very complicated stuff, so if anybody's getting lost, please tell me any questions so far. There's a lot of different crisscrossing shittas. So, yep. Yes.
So we have the Rambam saying that, oh, it'll, anytime she says Moed Salai, then we'll just immediately buy the like, we'll,
yeah, we'll, even that. Yeah, even that is a little bit subject to debate. On the surface, what it sounds like. On the surface, Rambam says that if she says Moed Salai, let's just give it with that kind of interpretation right now. If she says Moed Salai, so then we will be kofa. And then the way he explains it, which we haven't said yet, is Mipnei She'ena Kishvuye Islo, that she's not like a captive by him, but how are you going to force her to be physical with somebody who she finds repulsive? It's not fair, you can't do that, so therefore we will be called for him to divorce.
Was it someone who said that he's going to fly and move
up? Yes, so there are those who say in the Rambam that, there are those who say in general, so just to clarify this point, so I'm sorry that it's so complicated, but it's just the way this thing is, that there are those who invoke there needs to be an amasla. But an amasla normally means an explanation, a reason. Let's say if you, as you see in other contexts in the Gemara, if you lie, and then you want to say later I was lying, so you have to have an, if you want me to believe you now, you have to have an explanation why you lied. So that's an amasla. So to hear, she can't some say, Moed Salai, I'm not going to explain it, she has to substantiate it somehow. So what's the significance of that? So some say the Rambam needs that, others say the Rambam doesn't need that, but that the Machmirim would agree if there was that. The Ramah, he talks about namasla, but still doesn't say that. The Ramah says if there was namasla, then we won't force her to be with him, but doesn't say that they'll have to be.
Well, they
weren't
agree with the Rambam in theory. No one would say that she can say Moed Salai and have illegitimate claim if we're not with him.
Well, no, actually, most of the Rishonim do maintain that position. Yeah, the question is why not? Right, so that's the issue. They agree that we're not going to force her physically to be with him, but in terms of forcing a divorce. So most of the Rishonim do disagree with
the Rambam. They all come from the statement that maybe she wants to marry someone else.
So that's the question, right? So that was the time something we spent a lot of time talking about. So just to try to recap it now, that what's wrong with Rambam's equation? Because the first part of the statement, most of the Rishonim, if not all the Rishonim, agree with, right? That he says that she's not a captive who can be forced to be with him physically if she finds him repulsive. So all the Rishonim seem to agree like that, and that's what the Gemara sounds like. The Gemara says, essentially, that much the Gemara sounds like, right? That if she's rebelling against physical relationship with him because she finds it disgusting, it sounds like from the Gemara that's understandable. We don't know what the implications of being understandable, but it sounds like at least that much is understandable. So what's pshat then? So how is it that that's going to not lead to the Rambam's conclusion? The Rambam's conclusion seems to be pretty compelling. So there are two very different ways of approaching it. On the one hand, you have the Tosfos Rid. I strongly encourage you looking at that again. It's on the Daf, very major source. You know, again, there's so many different sources here, but if I highlight that it's worth gathering inside, it's a statement that it's particularly relevant. So the Tosfos Rid on the Samach Daled The Tosfos Rid essentially is very clear about what he says, a very important source, that basically he says the Tosfos Rid almost as much as the Rambam. But the problem is he doesn't cross the finish line, he doesn't say there will be kofa yet, because, as I think I didn't just ask, maybe we're afraid that Shema Nasna Ineha Ba'achet, that maybe she's interested in somebody else, and it's not really Ma'i Salai. So, in other words, it sounds like the Rambam theoretically, Tosfos Rid could have agreed with him, could have said that yes, the logic is there, we should be kofa yet, but we can't get involved that way because it's just something we're not able to observe. Now, think about that for a second, because there's a big discussion in the Rishonim and more in the Achronim. You know, what do the words Ma'is Alai mean? So does Ma'is Alai mean anything goes? That essentially it's a miscellaneous category. That it sounds like the word miscellaneous, right? It's a miscellaneous category that if she just says, I want out, then she's automatically out. Is that the story? Or is there some substance to it? So it sounds like many assume that it is at once both subjective and substantial. That it's subjective and invisible to outsiders. So no one else necessarily might be able to see what it is, and yet it's still real, and even if to everyone else he looks like the most fantastic guy in the world, that doesn't change it, it's still a valid, real feeling, but at the same time, we can't act upon it because we can't know that it's being honestly invoked, right? Those are some contradictory ideas all coexisting, right? That it's subjective but real, but not real enough for outsiders to act on, but real enough for us to credit that there's something there.
So what did Joseph Ritz say about her too? You know, he's agrees with the Rambam, but then
right.
That doesn't cross the finish line. So then we get down and you know, Kafka, she's Moreh, and then what
right.
Do you do?
So there's some significance. We'll have to come back to that point. We'll try to flip one point at a time. So the Tosfos Rid's point here is essentially that I agree with the Rambam in Svara, but not in practice. And again, this also provokes a discussion that Ma'is Alai, it sounds like it's something substantive while still being subjective, and some things will be outside. So if she's found interested in somebody else, that's not grounds to force a divorce. If she has some problem with him, the problem could be very subjective and something that only developed over the course of time, and no one else can cop what it is, all of that, fine, but still it has to be some kind of real revulsion to him. And some also note, some posts can make a big deal out of this, that the Tosfos Rid has the language of basically being anusa, that because she feels like this, it's impossible for her to be with him, that essentially it's not something that she can control, she just has a total distaste for him, it's not something that she can be asked to get over, it's not possible, and therefore that's also a part of it. So all of those different phrases are loaded and are all grounds for a lot of discussion. The Rambam also used the language sonui, that she finds him hateful, which is also probably significant. That maybe, again, is a threshold for the Rambam, but it's not just any type of expression that I want out, but that she finds him to be at least reaching some kind of threshold of hatefulness. So that's how the Tosfos Rid, and probably none of the other Rishonim would see it, that they hear where the Rambam's coming from, but for practical reasons we can't act on it. Now, there are those who are on the other side of the fence, like the Rush. And the Rush essentially says that it's more fundamental. The Rush says that Ma'is Alai is simply not grounds for forcing a divorce. It might be, as some have suggested, that because Ma'is Alai theoretically could change. So maybe we'll say, okay, however real it is, it still could change from one day to the next. Maybe the situations mentioned in the Gemara, those are permanent situations. So we'll say, listen, it's not going to get any better. So we'll have to force a divorce, which parenthetically opens up a whole other discussion, right? What if the husband develops a temporary condition? So it's not livable right now, but it's expected to pass. So how would that factor into the kfiyah beget? And also, how do we define temporary? Let's say the husband would develop a condition which would last for a few years, but then it could pass. So then is that viewed as temporary or permanent? Are you going to say to the woman she's expected to stay in a marriage and ride it out for a few years? Or is that not reasonable? So you have to figure out what's the difference between permanent and temporary and how would you define one or the other. So in any event, all of this is a part of the discussion. Maybe that's the issue of Ma'is Alai. It's real, but it could still change. So maybe we're not going to interfere with someone's marriage for that reason. So, in any event, the Rush basically has a more fundamental disagreement with the Rambam. The Rush simply understands it as not a good reason to force a divorce. But it's interesting from his language, because the Rush might define, his language might indicate that he defines Moyes Alai differently than the Rambam. In which case, maybe, or differently than the Rambam might define it. Certainly differently than Tosfos Rit. Because the Rush is not worried, Shema Nasta Naya Ba'acher. The Rush basically says, that's pshat. He says, why should we force a divorce? Why should we force a man to divorce his wife? Just because his wife decided that somebody else is more interesting and she wants to abandon her high school sweetheart and the father of her children because of this new attractive guy, that's not enough basis. You see, the Rush is working under the assumption that we're talking about a situation of Shema Nasna Einav Acher. Not that we're afraid of it, but that's really what's happening, and that's what he thinks Moyes Alai is, and it's not basically enough. So that opens the question, so does he really disagree with the Rambam, or maybe there's a Metzius issue here, that maybe the Rambam would also agree that's not enough, and he's talking about something else when he says Moyes Alai. So all of that is why there is much, much debate about the practicalities, and the question could also be asked, and again, are there Moyes Alai situations which are more objective or more visible and therefore would qualify? So we mentioned a few minutes ago, Roazonos might be an example of that. And maybe Roazonos, we said there's a bunch of different ways of understanding what the issue is with Roazonos. Maybe the issue is that that's something that makes the wife feel disgusted by him. She feels she can't be with a person who's doing this. And it's more objective than other types of Moyes Alai. It's the kind of behavior that justifiably provokes disgust in most people. And therefore, if that's what's going on, we can understand why she's going to have such a reaction. So that might be the case, and there is a whole discussion. We talked about one shuva that was written in the Sefer HaSan Mishpat that we went through a little bit, that he was describing a scenario where there was a bankruptcy that was brought on the whole family by the husband's very careless spending, and that since that was something that was demonstrable, so then maybe you could say that that's a situation of a visible Moyes Alai, and that maybe the Tosfos Rit, for example, might agree, because this isn't a situation where you have to think something else is going on. We also mentioned the Tshuva of the Sri Yesh, where he talked about a husband who's been arrested, and he wasn't ready to say that we should be kofah based on that. And there's a lot of literature about what's going to qualify, what's not going to qualify, and all of that enters into the discussion. We also saw a shuva of Rav Avadja we spent some time on. Rav Avadja was discussing whether or not if a couple is temani, so is that basis to say that since the temanim follow the Rambam in general, happens to be that in the time we first said this and now, I spent Shabbos with a temani Rav, who made the point that they don't follow the Rambam across the board. It's a little bit more complicated than that, but Rav Avadja was working off that premise. Sorry? No, from Los Angeles. But Rav Avadja was working off that premise. That was sort of what he was referring to there, that Temani couple in Eretz Yisrael. I also mentioned that Rav Schechter told me that Rav Kapach felt that the Rambam was right, but would only act upon it with a seerah for something else. And I said, well, Kapach was Temani, he maybe could follow the Rambam across the board, but Shatz with the couple wasn't Temani. So Rav Avadja is talking about a case where the couple was Temani, and he talks about the Betzira for a lot of other things he ends up allowing to be in the end of the Shuba, because he throws in a lot of other factors. But that's a whole part of the discussion, very complicated mathematics here. How do we add up the different elements? What's considered to be a justifiable Moyes Alai? What's an actionable Moyes Alai? How do the different parts come together? How does the different shittas we've shown him play out? All of this entering into the equation. So there's more to say about this, but that's some of the basic bread and butter of that discussion, which we'll say a little bit more about tomorrow. But before, let's say we'll stop for mincha now. Any questions? Again, we saw a lot of shittas back and forth. There was some complicated material there. Anything I need to repeat? Anything anybody wants to hear again? Okay, you feel you have a good piece on that? Okay, so hopefully tomorrow we'll be able to fill in some of the other major points. We have to still talk about our Chag Shemini Tam, things like that. And again, certainly also encourage you to chazer the chumash, before the Mishnah and the Torah for that game as well. So try to be aware of all that, and if we have time tomorrow, we'll also do that. And.